You are listening to a sermon by Laura Sportak, recorded on Sunday, November 19, 2017, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
And thank you for the music. It's always just right, so it's great. My purpose today is not so much to exegete these scriptures or to speak of the meaning of the cross, but to present this historic crucifixion to you as the backdrop for a reflection, a meandering sort of meditation on otherness. As a community, we claim to follow Jesus the Lamb, Jesus the Messiah, Jesus of Nazareth, the Jesus of many names and many identities around the world and throughout human history. In our following, how do we discern between that which heals and that which harms? I'm currently reading a book. I haven't finished it yet, but it's an amazing book, and it's concerned with this question, and the title is Religion That Heals, Religion That Harms, and it's written by James Griffiths, a psychiatrist who has worked with immigrants, refugees, mental health clients, in a word, many who are othered in society. Dr. Griffiths examines what people look for in spirituality in religion. He explores where these can go awry and where they can produce healing and enrich our human experience. He does not follow the common practice of vilifying religion and exalting spirituality. But he does make a distinction between the two. He defines spirituality as spirituality is about a person's beliefs, values, and behavior, while religiousness is about a person's involvement with a religious tradition and institution. He notes the spiritual and religious quests for some common goals: group security, personal morale boosting, and the cessation of suffering, and the ways in which each of these quests can result in consequences that are both healing and harmful. Griffiths asks, what is the distinguishing feature in a faith practice that heals rather than harms? And he proposes the use of what he rather somewhat shockingly calls the Nazi test. He cites examples of those committed to Nazi ideology, and they described their beliefs and values and justified their subsequent behavior in terms that can be eerily similar to faith commitments, and that also cite as their goals the search for ultimate meaning, deep feelings of purpose, positive emotions of a common community, and connection with the divine as legitimating factors. He concludes, it is possible to live a life of devotion to God, derive purpose from sacred teachings, find fellowship with other believers, and devote oneself selflessly to religious group missions, all the while showing indifference or even hatred towards those who do not belong to one's religious group or share a common group religious identity. So the Nazi test focuses attention upon the quality of relatedness with those who live outside one's group. And it separates personal spirituality from religious or ideological zeal. Religiousness is not spirituality when it sets relationships by first distinguishing whether a person is, quote, one of our own. As I read this, questions arise for me. Do I find congruence with such a definition of healthy spirituality within my Christian tradition over its long history? And I wonder, what quality of relatedness did Jesus demonstrate in his lifetime? All four gospel accounts tell us of the two men who were crucified with Jesus. In the Synoptic Gospels, they're identified as rebels or criminals. Some translations include Mark 15:28, which is the verse that points out the prophecy, "He was numbered with the transgressors." The Roman occupying forces clearly considered these men to not be one of our own. And the purity laws of the Jewish religious leaders would have pushed these two men beyond the boundary of inclusion, even if they were ethnically Jewish. Their deeds and their criminal history, which one of the criminal who, or the man on the cross who speaks, even self-identifies as someone who is deserving of the punishment they're experiencing. In three of the gospel accounts, no distinction is made between these two others. They're just jointly referred to as the others crucified with Jesus. After I'd read these gospel accounts through about five or six times, I started wondering if this didn't perhaps demonstrate a common characteristic of an in-group mentality. When we speak of us and them, the them tend to have an undistinguished mass of otherness, a din of noise and words. We do not hear the unique and worthwhile speech of any individual coming from the them. Merely the words and voice of a mob. They say, they believe, they transgress. But one of the gospel writers, Luke, actually breaks through this norm and presents to us, in the briefest of conversations, a glimpse of a distinct individual person. Mark and Matthew note that the two rebels participated with the crowd and the religious leaders in the mocking of Jesus, even as they themselves were being crucified. However, Luke's more nuanced account notes that only one of the two men crucified with Jesus mocked him. The other one spoke out in a voice unique from the derisive mob, from the leaders, from the soldiers, to give witness to Jesus' innocence. I wonder what it was that elicited this. We're not told. Take a moment to picture in your mind this scene. Imagine the landscape, the rocks, the shrubs, the trampled ground, the sun moving across the sky, marking the hours of their dying. Picture the people who were present. Jewish leaders, Jewish men, women, children, foreigners, dogs scavenging through the crowd, birds circling overhead, the grime, the sweat, the blood, the sounds of derision, of weeping, the pounding of hammers, and grunting efforts of the Roman soldiers doing their grim duty. And there they crucified him, and with him two others, one on each side, and Jesus in the middle. And there they crucified him, and with him two others, one on each side, and Jesus in the middle. Is it not curious that various details of these two others are included by all four gospel writers? Interestingly, John does not follow the synoptic tradition of naming them as rebels or criminals or transgressors. They are simply identified as two others. In his remarkable book, Exclusion and Embrace, Miroslav Volf reflects on the role of others in the formation of our identities as individuals and also as churches. He writes, using the word Catholic in its meaning of universal, and I had asked that this quote be in the bulletin because it's a little bit on the dense side. And I know some, I like to follow along when someone's reading something that has a lot packed into it. So if you'd like to follow with me as I read this quote. Consider what happens when a person becomes a Christian. Paul writes, "So if anyone is in Christ, there is a new creation. When God comes, God brings a whole new world. The Spirit of God breaks through the self-enclosed worlds we inhabit. The Spirit recreates us and sets us on the road towards becoming what I like to call a Catholic personality, a personal microcosm of the eschatological new creation. A Catholic personality is a personality enriched by otherness. A personality which is what it is only because multiple others have been reflected in it in a particular way. The distance from my own culture that results from being born by the Spirit creates a fissure in me through which others can come in. The Spirit unlatches the door of my heart, saying, 'You are not only you, others belong to you too.'" Wolf goes on to note that such Catholic personalities require communities that create space to receive the other, and he says every church must be open to all other churches. Now, lest you think he's proposing an international love fest where everyone and everything is welcome without judgment, on the very next page he says, "Any notion of Catholic personality which is capable only of integrating but not discriminating would be grotesque. There are evil deeds that cannot be tolerated. The practice of judgment cannot be given up. There can be no new creation without judgment." And hence the intriguing title of Wolf's amazing exploration of otherness, forgiveness, and the formation of identity, Exclusion and Embrace. Picture again, and there they crucified him, and with him two others, one on each side, and Jesus in the middle. If Miroslav Volf's claim that the Spirit unlatches the door of my heart, saying, "You are not only you, others belong to you too," is accurate of us, can we also view Jesus' interaction with one of his crucifixion neighbors in this light? Did the Spirit unlatch the doors of Jesus' heart? Was the anonymous other next to him suddenly a person whom Jesus felt a bond with? In his high priestly prayer, Jesus speaks of those given him by God. Jesus seems to have had a growing sense of his obligation to others, and I think he embraced this commission that you are not only you, others belong to you too. So now, with Jesus in the middle, between these two others, we hear two very different choices. One a voice of mocking, and one a voice going against the insults and derision of the mob, and bearing witness to innocence. One of the criminals who had hung there hurled insults at Jesus, saying, "Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us." But the other criminal rebuked him, saying, "Don't you fear God, since you are under this sentence of death? We are punished justly, for we are getting what our deeds deserve, but this man has done nothing wrong." Then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Jesus responds with a pronouncement, a judgment. But it is not a judgment against, Rather, it's a judgment for. Jesus discriminates in favor of the other who spoke the truth of his innocence. Truly, I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise. In the midst of abusive language being hurled at him, facing imminent death, and no doubt bearing great physical, mental, and spiritual pain, the judgment Jesus pronounces from the cross turns out to be a blessing, affirming this choice of the other. Yet even as he made this pronouncement, Jesus remained in the middle, with one on each side. Could this be what inclusion looks like? Could this be the picture of religion that heals over against religion that harms? To discriminate between abusive slander and hatred and words of truth. To speak blessing towards the person choosing the truth, but to remain silent towards the hatred and the slander. And all the while remaining in the middle, so as to continue to listen to the voices of the others, to bear witness to their existence, to extend a blessing whenever possible, and so bring healing. But as always, another question arises. Is this therapy of listening, witnessing, and extending small kindnesses enough? The ills of the world are so catastrophic, so horrible. Are not far more drastic and dramatic remedies required of us? I suppose the answer depends on what one expects and also on the details of each particular situation. But I know that the drastic and dramatic remedies of history, the Crusades and the Inquisitions, have never healed. They have only exponentially increased the harm. So I will risk a yes, voicing my belief that it is enough to listen to witness, and to bless the other. It is enough to make this small beginning. It's enough to plant this tiny seed from which human potential in the other for hope, resilience, survival, and flourishing springs, even when one is immersed in terrible suffering with death imminent. When Jesus told his crucifixion neighbor, "You will be with me in paradise," that neighbor still hung on the cross. Jesus' words brought no immediate change of circumstance. We know that both of these slowly dying two others outlived Jesus, so they saw him die. John records that their legs were broken so as to hasten their deaths, and he tells us Jesus had already died. Therefore, no bones were broken in his body. So in those hours, did only one of the two others cling to Jesus' promise of inclusion in the words, "You will be with me in paradise"? Did the angry other turn from his mocking, regret his choice, and wish he'd spoken differently? We do not know. And as always, in our not knowing, there's room for hope. We do know what was offered to the one who turned and spoke to Jesus. He received the words, "You will be with me in paradise." Now, much has been made of the words "in paradise" as though that was the blessing Jesus granted to this one of the two others. But I find myself wondering if perhaps this dying other who had dared to speak the truth that he saw did not find more comfort in the promise of companionship, in the words of human solidarity. "You will be with me, you, me," in the same sentence. In this gospel account, we have the privilege of witnessing an intimate I-thou moment. Martin Buber said of such encounters, when two people relate to each other authentically and humanly, God is the electricity that surges between them. Maybe this is the way in which we can fulfill Jesus' call for us, his followers, to be lights in this world. On occasion, we participate in the creation of light as we connect with those others we find ourselves between and in the midst of. Always, we can choose to be open to relatedness, especially relatedness that reaches beyond the boundaries of the familiar and the conventions of social and cultural tradition. Always, in any circumstances, we can choose to witness to a common humanity. And always we have the choice of kindness. And sometimes we receive the grace to see past the labels of rebel, criminal, terrorist, transgressor, and even the label of other. And instead, like Jesus, we get to say to the person beside us, "You with me. Me with you." And that is, I'm certain, one step towards paradise.